Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this Federalist Society virtual event. I'm Caroline Bryant, and I'm the Associate Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Today, we're excited to host this webinar on digital assets market structure reform. Our moderator today is Pat Doherty. Pat is a senior corporate and securities law partner of Foley & Lardner, LLP, based in Chicago. He's also an adjunct professor of law at Cornell Law School, where he teaches in residence each fall term. After our panel gives their presentation, we will turn to you, the audience, for questions. If you have a question, please enter it into the Q&A function at the bottom of your Zoom window. We will do our best to answer as many as we can. Finally, I'll note that, as always, all expression of opinion today are those of our guest speakers, not the Federalist Society. With that, Pat, thank you so much for joining us, and the floor is yours.
Thank you, Caroline. I'll begin by introducing the topic, and then I'm going to pose some questions to our panelists, who I will identify to you and describe to you as we proceed, to save a bit of time. But you can ask questions yourselves as we proceed by, you can do it electronically here. So feel free to do that using the Q&A button, and we'll take those questions up as we go along, or perhaps save some to the end. So the title is Digital Assets Market Structure Reform. What are digital assets? I'm going to use SEC Commissioner Peirce's taxonomy. She says there's four kinds of digital assets. There are crypto assets with the intrinsic characteristics of securities. An example of that would be common stock. Then there are crypto assets that are offered and sold as part of an investment contract. That's a complicated subject. Then third, there are tokenized securities, like tokenized stock or bonds. Then fourth, there are all other crypto assets, which are not securities, showing perhaps a change in viewpoint. Chair Gensler used to say that virtually all or the substantial majority of crypto assets are securities. Hester Peirce says that this is the biggest category and these are not securities at all. So that's what digital assets are. What is market structure? Market structure is market regulation of two markets, primary markets and secondary markets. The primary markets are when the instrument, if you want to call it an instrument, the token is offered and sold initially. We won't say by whom, that's kind of an issue into itself, but also secondary markets, such as exchanges, dealers, traders, funds, custodians, clearing agencies, and such. Why do we need reform? This is digital assets market structure reform. Well, if you're asking that question, you must have been living under a rock since about 2017, because it's been fairly chaotic in these last several years. There is no uniform federal law of crypto asset regulation. What we have is a hodgepodge of securities laws, commodities, derivatives laws, money transmission laws, banking laws, and such. At a minimum, it is felt that what we need is clarity around what is and isn't a security, as otherwise you might well be violating the securities laws by offering, selling, or trading tokens. Now, on this panel, to address questions about market structure reform, we have a venture investor in Miles Jennings from A16Z. We have a builder in Lee Schneider from Ava Labs. We have an exchange. Well, they're not actually these entities. They're, you know, employees by or representatives of an exchange. In this case, Justin Wales from crypto.com. And we have a broker dealer expert in Stephen Lafke. So we will explore the regulation of primary and secondary digital assets markets. Briefly, because I'm talking too much, here's how it works now. The SEC regulates markets and securities. The CFTC regulates markets and derivatives and swaps. With minor exceptions, no one regulates cash commodities, including crypto assets that are not securities. The states and the feds all regulate money transmission. The states also police securities markets. And of course, other nations have their own regimes. It's very complex. So I'm going to start with you, Miles, if you don't mind, and ask you about the primary markets for digital asset offerings. There is a House bill, or there's a House discussion draft, I should say, that would enact some market structure reforms. What do you think of that bill as it relates to primary markets? Does it work? Does it improve things? Talk to us about it a little bit, if you would.
Yeah, so I think that the, you know, the draft that's currently, in the House, I think that it was just announced today that there's going to be an actual bill proposed tomorrow, is an updated version of FIT 21, which was a bill that was passed in the House last Congress in 2024. So the bill has several different components. It has with respect to primary offerings, it has a crowdfunding regime. So that kind of tailors, provides a pathway for issuers to issue tokens to the general public. It has a secondary markets kind of regime where it tailors transfer restrictions, selling restrictions on insiders based on kind of the maturity of the project. And then it has an intermediary based regulatory regime, both under securities laws and under commodities laws. This is a regime basically regulating brokers, dealers, exchanges. And then it has a safe harbor for DeFi. So speaking to the kind of first two components, right? I think that the primary mechanism of the bill is to basically say, primary transactions of digital assets are going to be subject to securities laws and continue to be subject to securities laws, right? Secondary transactions are not going to be subject to securities laws. Now, obviously, if you are, think about that, right? That creates a fairly significant potential loophole where a issuer could circumvent the securities laws restrictions in the primary markets and move to the secondary market simply by selling through an intermediary, which would then defeat the purpose of applying securities laws to the primary transactions. So the way that the bill tries to prevent that kind of circumvention is to apply, a transfer restrictions lockup period, right, on people that are acquiring the digital asset from the issuer in the primary transactions. So what it essentially says is, if you are, a VC investor like us, an entrepreneur, right, you've received tokens from the company in a primary transaction, that would be subject to securities laws, so likely issued to the person via an available exemption. Then in the secondary markets, you're restricted from basically selling into those markets, subject to the kind of maturity of the project itself. That maturity concept is one that is based on control. So it's essentially the concept is, where these blockchain networks are functioning without, a human intervention, where they are autonomous, where they are, not controlled by any individual, right? Then the risk profile of the underlying asset looks very different from a security. Obviously, Apple significantly controls every element of their business, right? And then that means that they basically control the risk profile of a share of Apple stock, right? Whereas an asset like Bitcoin or Ethereum, right? There is no, person that controls the risk profile of that asset. Therefore, we think that there should be a different path other than kind of the disclosure requirements of ordinary securities laws. So that concept of network maturity is basically used as a mechanism mechanism to ensure that when insiders, those that are most likely to have, you know, potential information asymmetries, are able to participate in secondary markets, right, that the asset at that time functions less like a security and more like an ordinary commodity. So that's kind of the core innovation of the regulatory scheme. There's a bunch of other stuff in there, right? So there's a disclosure regime, right, which will help introduce, you know, or help lessen information asymmetries across the board. That disclosure regime is a lighter touch disclosure framework than ordinary securities laws, right? So this is an alternative path for digital assets. Now, going back to the primary markets, there, the crowdfunding regime, there is a proposal in there right now that would allow, you know, issuers to, you know, based on just a white paper, to raise capital from the general public in the US, right? And that should be helpful in kind of making sure that these assets are distributed broadly across their communities, which is overall fairly helpful for decentralization for achieving network maturity. So the bill has a lot of good pieces in it. I think that it's, you know, it's important to kind of make sure that the restrictions all kind of are dialed correctly to ensure that the, you know, the maturity framework works correctly, that people are properly incentivized, that there aren't kind of workarounds where, you know, you're going to end up exposing retail consumers to harm. But fundamentally, that's the general scheme that's being used. Now, I think it's a significant improvement off of the SEC's, you know, existing or historical approach, right, which was, you know, really a decentralization concept that didn't just focus on control, what the maturity concept in the bill focuses on. The SEC's decentralization concept historically has focused on ongoing efforts of individuals. The reason that that was, you know, very problematic is it essentially incentivized entrepreneurs to abandon their projects or to hide their ongoing efforts, right? The deal was, hey, if you're engaged in ongoing efforts, we're going to subject you to securities laws, right? And all the onerous burdens that come with it. So entrepreneurs would say, hey, we're not engaged in ongoing efforts, like look somewhere else, mm-hmm. right? So that obviously is not a great incentive for a technology industry, where you obviously want entrepreneurs working very hard on their projects. So I think moving away from the efforts-based disclosure or efforts-based, you know, decentralization regime towards a control-based decentralization regime is very helpful, right? Control is one where you're looking more not where the entrepreneurs are actually providing ongoing efforts, but whether or not they control those systems. Do the systems function more like public infrastructure, or do they function more like proprietary technology? So again, I think that that's a significant improvement and one that aligns with the public interest. And then also, right, the SEC's regime was one that kind of applied at the outset, right? If you are issuing, you know, tokens and the general public is trading them, you know, they're looking at, is it decentralized at that time? And if it's not, then, you know, they were you know, their goal was then applying securities laws in those cases. I think under the market structure legislation, right, you provide a pathway for what is known in the industry as progressive decentralization, which is that you don't have to be decentralized right at the outset. You don't have to hand over control right at the outset. That would, you know, expose users to potential risks, but you allow them to decentralize over time. And the way that you protect consumers in the meantime is by, you know, boxing the insiders that are most likely to have inside information, VCs, entrepreneurs, right, from participating in those markets.
That's very thoughtful, Miles. You probably know more about decentralization than anyone I know. So I want to stay on that topic a little bit with you. And I noticed in the maturity concept in the bill, which is fascinating, and there are multiple ways that you can show that you're mature, or that your system is mature. There's also this concept of functionality, full functionality. And my read on that is that even if you're not decentralized, so long as you're fully functional, it's also not a security. Do you read it that way too? And how do you feel about that?
Well, I think that functionality is there's the way that the maturity test works is there's a principles-based test, right? Which is the network controlled? And if the network is not controlled, then, you know, none of the secondary market transfer restrictions or trading restrictions apply. But that principles-based test, right, is obviously one that provides, you know, a lot of flexibility to regulators, but doesn't provide a lot of clarity to entrepreneurs as to what control might mean, right? Control is a pretty well-known concept under securities laws, but, you know, any lawyer could look at a system and come up to a different conclusion as to whether or not something is control. So to kind of address that shortcoming of a principles-based regime, which again provides a lot of flexibility, there is a rules-based safe harbor in the bill that establishes, I think, 5 or 6 criteria that says, look, if you meet these 5 or 6 criteria, then you will be deemed not to be controlled. And that is where the functionality requirement comes. I think that the requirements there are, is the asset kind of economically independent of a DevCo, right? So is value accruing to it other than, from the DevCo, which is obviously important because if the value is coming from a centralized organization, then, clearly that organization has some level of control. Functionality is just, does the system, function and enable people to use it the way that it is intended to function. So, can you transmit assets? Can you, so that's kind of the piece there, but it's not its own, separate thing that's all you need to achieve. The third one, I think, is programmatic, which is really kind of a nod to autonomous functioning of these networks, right? That they can function without human intervention and control. And then there is, let's see, what are the other two? I think it's something around governance, right? Which is ensuring that, where there is token-based governance or ownership of these assets, that you don't have significant concentrated interests that are then able to control the system. And I'm blanking on the last one at the moment, but...
That's okay. Let me ask Lee about this, because I know you have thoughts around decentralization too. How do you understand decentralization, Lee? And does this bill conform with that?
So I don't think the bill's about decentralization. I think it's about network maturity. And as somebody who's been very immature his whole life, I totally discredit that concept. No, I'm just kidding. I think Miles gave a great summary. This idea about decentralization, to my mind, it works on a bunch of different levels and sort of depends on what you're talking about. So the way that the bill goes up, the draft bill goes about it, I think is a pretty good job of trying to cut some of the issues and draw some lines for people to follow. I think it's important, as Miles notes, that the sort of deemed mature portion of the bill is not mandatory. It's a safe harbor. And so that there are other ways to have your network deemed mature or have your network become mature and satisfy the requirements. I think that's very important because if there was only one way to do it, then we would be forcing everybody in a particular direction, which to my mind is never a super good idea. When I think about decentralization of a network, I think about it more in the sense of the technology terms, and in particular about finality of transactions on the network, since to me, that's what Bitcoin is all about, right? How do we create this finality so that people can rely on the fact that you can't have a double spend problem? So when I think about decentralization, that's my natural focus, but I can understand why that doesn't necessarily work in the context of, what should be within the SEC's jurisdiction and sort of when we should be thinking about these assets in a particular way. I do just want to make one point. As I said, I think Miles did a really good summary. I think there's a huge temptation to talk about it as if the tokens are securities and all of that kind of stuff. One of the things that I like about the bill is that it in fact says that there's a difference between the investment contract and the quote unquote digital commodity, or they call it investment contract asset for purposes of the bill, draft bill. And I really like that. That's a concept that I have espoused for a long time. And I was gratified to see that appear in the draft bill. I'll be interested to see if it survives the round of comments that everybody gave. But I think that's an incredibly important thing, right? The idea is not that the token is a security. And in my view, when you look at this definition of digital commodity that they proposed in the draft bill. Those things to me are never securities, but they may be part of an investment contract. And, you know, an investment contract is a type of security. And so we need to grapple with that from a legal standards standpoint. So I think that distinction is very important. And it's one that I hope is carried forward in subsequent versions that are introduced and hopefully the final legislation that's passed.
I have a couple other questions actually for both of you, and maybe others will have views on these questions too. One is that the way the bill works is the draft bill is that, you're under the securities law regime for 1, 2, 3, 4 years until you mature. And then voila, you're no longer filing with the SEC. Now you're essentially reporting to the CFTC.
So I actually don't read it that way, Pat. Okay. I'm sorry to interject.
Give me your view on that, would you?
Yeah, and I'd be interested to hear what Miles and the other folks have to say. But that was Fit 21. And they were trying to make a dividing line there. And I found that dividing line was a little uncomfortable. And I didn't think it worked particularly well, because you could be in a situation where, you know, you have a decentralized network. So you're CFTC, then all of a sudden, somehow the network gets centralized and you're SEC. And so you could bounce back and forth. And there were other problems with that. The way I read this current draft, what they're really saying is, to use your terminology from the beginning, primary market stuff, that's SEC jurisdiction.
Right.
Secondary market stuff, that's CFTC jurisdiction. And SEC regulated intermediaries are allowed to participate in the secondary market through this notice filing with the CFTC, which I think is a really good idea and a nice way to ensure as broad and robust a marketplace for digital commodities as possible. But I don't think we have this kind of, you can be in both places. Okay. No, that's the wrong way to say it. I don't think we have this sort of, you can bounce back and forth between both places. I think secondary markets, that's CFTC. Primary market, and you said, whatever issuer means, however that works, obviously different projects will do things in different ways and the token distributions will happen in different ways. And there can be all kinds of nuance there that is important to think about when you're going to launch your project. It's important to think about how you're going to do that to achieve the goals that you want to achieve with the project, et cetera, et cetera. And it looks like be important once the legislation comes out, but that's sort of the way that I break it out in my head. Yeah. Primary market, secondary market.
Totally. Is that how you see it, 2 miles? Is that?
Yeah, that's exactly right. So SEC has oversight of primary, CFTC has oversight of secondaries.
Right.
He is absolutely right. That's the
even once it's mature, it's still SEC. Is your view
still CFTC? So for the
primary though, once it's mature, is my point.
So the primary market, right? The primary transactions are always regulated as securities transactions. The maturity concept doesn't really apply in any context outside of the secondary market, right? Where it looks at whether or not insiders can participate in that market. Now, the only caveat that I would take to what Lee said, which is absolutely right, that was a significant improvement over Fit 21. Fit 21 was a world where, insiders remain subject to securities laws, whereas as kind of outsiders were able to participate freely in the digital commodity markets. Now everyone's in the digital commodity market under the CFTC's authority. The only caveat is that if you use the crowdfunding pathway, right, then you have a disclosure obligation with the SEC, right? So you're filing disclosures with the SEC. That filing obligation continues, right, even though those assets are now part trading in secondary markets, and the SEC doesn't have oversight over that market, right? So the primary issuance triggers a disclosure obligation that then carries forward, and that's actually, I think, a nice way to split the baby here, because it gives the SEC some oversight of that secondary market, particularly with respect to disclosures, which is obviously a thing that it has a lot of history and experience dealing with. Right. But you're not kind of now forcing those assets back into the SEC's regime or treating them like they're securities when they clearly are not. The CFTC has authority over those markets.
But to be clear, if you made a primary offering of in a mature ecosystem of the asset, that would still be in the SEC's domain, as I understand it.
That's right. But the, you know, those assets could then, you know, would then be once the person acquires those assets, right, the restrictions they're subject to are under the CFTC regime, not the SEC's.
But the SEC gets a view at it. They see the disclosure. And then if there's fraud, they can police the fraud. And if there's something funny going on with the secondary market, they can point it out to the CFTC, which can do something about it. Got it. Thanks. Let me ask you one more question. Then I'm going to go to Miles. Then I'm going to go to Justin. What happens if we don't get legislation here? Okay. I think there's a strong drive to land the airplane, is how I've been, you know, heard it described. And that we, you know, that the, you know, the industry wants this bill. Well, I tend to think it's a very good idea myself. But what if it doesn't happen? What can the SEC do itself to facilitate primary transactions better than it has under its existing rulemaking authority? Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think, look, it would be a real shame if we don't get legislation passed. I think that the only way that you can have a real solid foundation upon which entrepreneurs can build and investors can invest, right, is to have certainty, you know, on a go forward basis. And without legislation, right, there's no certainty, even no matter how good of a job the SEC does over the course of the next few years, right, you can't build an empire in a few years. And so as a result of that, we desperately think that market structure legislation is necessary. Now, that said, right, what the SEC has done thus far this year has been absolutely incredible, right? I mean, they have stopped the Lawfare, and that has been an incredible advancement for the industry. And I think everyone is now kind of looking and optimistic about what they can build rather than pessimistic and worried about, you know, getting a knock on their door from the SEC for some, you know, outrageous charge. So already significant improvement. Everything that's coming out of the SEC thus far, right, all of the statements, all of the guidance that they've provided have been helpful, have provided clarity. It kind of highlights, right, how weaponized the institution had become under the last administration, right? They just didn't effectively do anything that was helpful. And in fact, you know, all of the aggression that they took, I would say, harmed investors more than actually helped them. Now, all that said, you know, the SEC does have, Hester Peirce has put out a safe harbor proposal that would provide a pathway for, digital assets to exist under their authority. What I would say that and I think that they're continuing to work on that kind of stuff. Obviously, they did the request for information a few months ago, and I think that there's been a lot of submissions in response to that. She just spoke recently and kind of laid out a lot of great thoughts about how to kind of approach the regulatory scheme. I would say that, you know, so we're very optimistic about what the SEC can do, right? I would say that the one issue there, right, is that they don't technically have, right, the authority to regulate this market effectively. Because at the end of the day, as Lee was just saying, these assets themselves are not securities, right? Sometimes they're sold in securities transactions, but the application of the Howey test to secondary market transactions is incredibly difficult, involves a ridiculous subjective assumption, assessment on the part of the SEC as to where ongoing efforts, where there's reasonable reliance on ongoing efforts. So it's just not really all that workable. But the problem is that the SEC is bound by case law, right? And they can't kind of just go and create a whole new regulatory framework that isn't, that is not kind of attached to the existing case law and the existing laws. So they're
saying that they can't, Miles, but they sure gave it a good try.
They absolutely did during the last.
I think we're all in agreement about that. I think we're all in. And to that point, really. Could Congress do a better job of defining security as applicable to crypto assets, to digital assets? there's still some uncertainty about what is and is not a security under the draft bill.
Yeah, I think that's right. But Pat, I mean, the problem is, and Hester actually referenced this in her speech the other day, right, is that, like, you know, look, for all of the problems that the Howey test, you know, has, right, and how we saw that weaponized against the industry, right, its core principle, right, looking at the economic reality of transactions, right, I think is a sound one, right? And I think if you tried to, you know, turn that from a principles-based test into a rules-based test, right, well, you would just be creating a form over substance test, which is never a good idea, right? So yeah, I'm sympathetic with the idea that, you know, better, more clarity would be helpful, all of this stuff, right? But I think trying to just go back and change securities laws to focus more on form as opposed to substance would potentially open up a lot of avenues for
non-traditional assets like crypto assets. I think that's right. And that's good, because that means there'll be jobs for securities lawyers, even if the law passes. Okay. So Justin, you've been very patient with us, and I appreciate that. Let's talk about exchanges a little bit. Crypto.com is a very important exchange. Describe how you operate now. What are the various markets that you participate in? How can a customer, I mean, for example, you know, we have cash market crypto, there are derivatives and swaps, there are real world assets that have been tokenized, stable coins. We're not going to talk about stable coins today. That's a different webinar. But you know, what can you access and do on the crypto.com platform? How does that work?
Sure. Our primary offering is really we're a store in which you can buy digital assets directly from us as the counterparty. Can you guys hear me? Okay, good. Yeah. Beyond that, we have a broker dealer where you could buy stocks. We have a derivatives platform registered with the CFTC where you can participate in different derivatives, including events contracts. And they're all offered under one app. But behind the scenes, there are different entities that you are interacting with. Things are segregated, different terms, right? So from a user's perspective, except for perhaps the onboarding, where if you're onboarding onto a new product, you're agreeing to a new set of terms, it pretty much looks like a one offering, one set of products. And I think it's pretty streamlined once you get past the onboarding, and it works okay. I think there's a question about how can you integrate everything into one registered entity, and what would that look like? And I think there's a huge number of questions of how does that functionally work, and would that work better than this segregated offering that we and others sort of have set up. You know, the market structure bill has a lot of interesting proposals. I think it's taking a step in the right direction, but a lot of it says, we're not going to answer all of the details now. It's going to be subject to SEC rulemaking.
Yes.
And that's where the devil of the details is. So it is sort of a chicken and the egg, which is, yeah, this all looks like it's going in the right direction, or at least parts of it are headed the right way. But what do things like custody look like? What do things like settlement look like under these new structures? And we have a lot of questions about that. With regard to just the market structure bill generally, I do think that there's a couple of fundamental questions that we have to just grapple with. One is, as you said, and I've heard this phrase 1,000 times, we got to land the plane. It's almost like a joke now, right? And we're all like battered children over the last 4 years and say, we just have to have some clarity. We have to have something that's, you know, gives us some confidence moving into whatever the next administration is going to be. So let's get something done. And it's almost an assumption of like, okay, if we're going to get something done, part of it has to go to the SEC, part of it has to go to the CFTC. Let's put aside what is the role of the states under this new regime. But we're not grappling with the questions. Well, what is the role of the SEC and what is the role of the CFTC? So under most proposals that I've seen, we're basically assuming that all primary market sales of digital assets are, if not securities, should just be treated as securities. And we should expand what the SEC's role in that market should be. And also that the CFTC should expand their role into spot sales of digital assets. Add on top of that, this other confusion that is developing, which is right now it's really hard to understand, well, what is a security under the Howey test as related to an investment contract that has a digital asset? Well, now add to it, well, what is a digital asset commodity and how does that differ than something like a meme coin or some other asset that just might happen to be digital, but doesn't fit into a proposed definition of digital asset commodity? So my concern, just as someone working in the industry moving forward, is we're replacing one pretty difficult to navigate four-part test with several multi-factor tests, and it just becomes really difficult for us to operate. The other I think difficulty that I have with some of it is we assume, okay, the SEC's jurisdiction is this box and the CFTC's jurisdiction is this box and the state's jurisdiction is this box, and they're all neat and discreet. But the reality is when you're regulated by the CFTC or the SEC or the states, they take a broader view of their jurisdiction often than what their guidance, yes, right, proposes. So I hear a lot about, we want to have market structure. Wouldn't you rather have a one federal regulator than 50 state regulators? The reality is you're still going to have the 50 state regulators because you're almost certainly going to need a money transmission license for other aspects of the business. They're not going to give up their oversight. And what are you going to say to your state regulator? This is none of your business. You're going to sue them. It just doesn't work. So the reality is you're just adding more and more layers of regulation. I do think we need federal regulation, but I think we need to do it thoughtfully in a way that doesn't, one, make it even more complicated to deal with, but also, I mean, for the primary issuance question, there was a joke that, you know, the first five lawyers that a company has in the digital asset space have, the first five employees that the digital asset company has to hire as a lawyer, like one of the first five. Now it might be the first three or maybe the first two. Before you can do anything, you have to figure out, well, what is the strategy to get something to market? And I just don't believe that you can have a mature market without having a digital asset sale, a primary digital asset sale, because you need some amount of people joining your network in order for it to become mature in the first place. So it becomes this chicken and the egg that I think we haven't really grappled with yet.
I think, though, that just to be fair, Justin, right, I think that like that chicken or egg problem is much worse under the current paradigm where you have to be decentralized in order, yeah, to issue a token, and you can't issue a token without being decentralized. Yes. I mean, I agree that the crowdfunding regime that's proposed under the bill is, you know, does have some, you know, requirements to it, requires you to put together disclosures. That's probably going to require them to hire a lawyer. But at the end of the day, you know, what's the alternative, right? That people can just conduct ICOs without any regulation.
Yeah. You know, one of the great things about the bill is that you'll be able to do what I would consider an ICO in the United States. I mean, you're going to have to follow, you know, the conditions laid out for us under the securities laws, but it will be possible to do that. And you really can't do that now, in my view.
Yeah, and that crowdfunding regime is much more lenient and flexible than what, you know, existing crowdfunding regimes are for ordinary securities, right? So you can, it's just the filing of a white paper. You don't have to go through a notice and comment period with the SEC. So there isn't an ability for the SEC to actually hold those things up.
I'm going to interrupt this webinar with a commercial announcement, okay? Because Justin Wales, right here, has just released the second edition of his book, The Crypto Legal Handbook, which I think is available on Amazon. Worth buying and reading, in my view. By the way, we have other authors here. I mean, everyone on this panel has done a lot of scholarship. Miles, I mean, if you want to read all about decentralization and how to do a token offering, just go to the A16Z crypto website and it's all there for free. His name's on a lot of that stuff. Steve Lofke, who I'm not allowed to say anything yet, is the author of Lofke on Broker Dealers, which is a treatise that Hester likes to cite. And Lee Schneider is a podcast with All Explained. So a lot of scholarship around this if people want to follow up. We had a question or two in the audience. I don't know. Have you answered those? You know, they've been dealt with. I think so. Any comment on the kidnapping of the crypto king and balancing some investigation with currency privacy? I don't know. Anyone have a comment on that? I haven't really been tracking it myself. There was also a question I saw earlier about, you know, didn't the SEC win most of these cases?
No.
They won. They did not. They got a lot of consent decrees.
I was at the Western Securities Forum a couple of weeks ago, and there was a guy named John Reed Stark, who is a fairly well known anti-crypto advocate, and he went on and saying, like, look at all the cases that the SEC won. They were, 10-0, whatever, and he starts citing all these settlement agreements. Now, here's a good example of like one of the settlement agreements that he cited, that is often cited, this case called Munchie, which is a company that raised $60,000 in a token offering. The SEC went to them and said, we're going to basically litigate you to damnation unless you agree to the settlement. Now, is that a win or not? I don't consider that a win. And I think actually like, they certainly won some. I mean, they won the library case. They won Terraform, but they didn't win Ripple. They weren't. It didn't look like they were trending in the direction of a win for Binance. It was a little more up in the air with Kraken and Coinbase, but the questions weren't fully settled by courts. And one of the things that I often tell people is don't have such a short memory right now over what the cases were in the prior administration, because you're seeing the same sorts of arguments pop up in civil litigations and at a state level. So they didn't win, but it was a mixed bag, but the arguments are still sort of floating around in the ether, to use a pun.
Yeah. Yeah, I think I agree with that. I think that consent decrees just don't count, and they had dozens of them, but who cares? There are a lot of reasons to settle a case, and being wrong is one of them, but it is hardly the most important or the usual one. So I think we agree about that. Steve, let's talk a little bit about broker-dealers. And I want to tie this to the way exchanges operate. So, and Justin, I assume you don't have broker dealers who are members of crypto.com. If I'm wrong about that, say so. But for a registered securities exchange, you must be a broker dealer to be a member of the exchange. You know, ordinary people like you and me are not members of such exchanges. We have to operate through a broker.
I'm gonna respond and like any good lawyer, duck your question wherever you're going. So first of all, let me throw out one bit of common wisdom, which is totally untrue, which is that regulation should be technology independent. If ever there was a conversation that demonstrated that regulation cannot be technology independent, this was it. Now I'm going to jump to the notice to members that the SEC, or if, sorry, that that the FAQ. I apologize. That the SEC put out dealing with capital, custody, and essentially bankruptcy, which are the three you know, most important broker dealer issues. Mm-hmm. Everything else, like suitability, best ex, you know, that's they're important issues, but they do not they don't compare to the significance of capital, custody, and bankruptcy. I mean, think Lehman Brothers or Bear Stearns. Mm-hmm. Those are the issues that really matter. Now, the basic rule of dealing with regulation, and it's really in every financial sector, is if you can avoid it, avoid it. If you're giving advice to a broker dealer, the first thing, the first rule is don't put any asset or activity in a broker dealer that you can avoid putting in the broker dealer. You're going to subject yourself to regulation that you would not otherwise be subject to. Now, what's the purpose of capital regulation? It's largely to prevent the broker dealer from going bankrupt and hurting customers. If a market maker that doesn't have any customers goes bankrupt, you know, of course, it's a shame for the employees and to some extent for the creditors, but customers aren't hurt. So it follows that capital regulation and custody regulation, you know, they're not about facilitating the crypto markets. They're about protecting customers of the broker dealer. So you need those regulations to be conservative, which means that you need to impose a significant capital charge for holding crypto assets for the most part. I can talk about Bitcoin and Ether, but can treat those as special cases. So I've got a digital asset, mm-hmm. which is not a security, mm-hmm. and I have a capital regime that needs to be conservative because I need to protect customers. Mm-hmm. Where am I going to hold that digital asset? Quick answer, not in the broker dealer. Right. I'm not going to trade it in the broker dealer. I'm not going to hold it in the broker dealer. I am not going to hold it in a capital regulated entity. I mean, that just is kind of financial regulation 101. You do not put something in a regulated entity that does not need to be in a regulated entity. So where is this conversation going as far as the role of broker-dealers or investment banks? Well, they can be agents in the secondary, you know, they can be agents in the placement as they are for private securities. They could take an asset on their books like a 144A and flip it right away, but they are not going to want to hold an asset that has zero value for capital purposes. That is a bad asset to hold. So you're going to have to set up an entity which is separate from your broker dealer, which is not capital regulated, to hold an asset that does not subject you to capital regulation. I mean, that's just, you know, kind of common sense financial regulation. This is how we do it. You don't put assets in a regulated entity that don't need to be there.
No, so thank you. And that suggests that...
Wait, Pat, are we allowed to...
comment? Sure, if you have thoughts on that, Lee, please do.
Yeah, Steve just proved out that technology neutral regulation when it comes to digital assets is possible. So thank you, Steve. That was great.
My thought was, okay, in this case, then maybe the exchanges, if it's going to be an SEC, but they won't be under the bill, it wouldn't be an SEC registered exchange. But
but when you look at the when you look at the bill and all of the requirements that the CFTC, all the rulemakings the CFTC is going to have to do around these digital commodity exchanges, they're going to look pretty close to what SEC regulated national securities exchanges look like. And that's even more so with regard to the digital asset broker or digital commodity brokers and digital commodity dealers. So I actually think you know, looping back to some of the points that Justin was making, I think that's actually one of the shortcomings of the bill, is that it's going to require a huge amount of rulemaking by the CFTC. And that's going to be an incredibly long and laborious process. I know that they try to allow people to be those kinds of intermediaries in the interim. But I do think there could be some streamlining there that would be quite helpful.
Yeah. Steve, here's another one for you about that FAQ that Trading and Markets put out on the 15th. You know, it says, question. Are unregistered investment contract crypto assets covered by SIPC? Answer, no. No, they are not. So I have crypto assets that are deemed to be securities because they are investment contracts. They haven't been registered with the SEC because none of them has. Are those covered by SIPC if they're held by the broker-dealer? The answer is no, which means they're uninsured. Okay.
It's not just that they're uninsured.
Yeah.
And this goes to the custom protection asset. Are they part of the liquidation scheme, or are they?
Right.
Because if they're part of the liquidation scheme, then there's a danger to the other customers that, let's say, there's an event with respect to the broker dealer's holding of crypto assets that are securities, but are not just investment contracts, or maybe they are investment contracts. So, you know, first you begin with the allocation of the broker dealer's assets to its customers. And then after that, if there's a shortfall, which in the ordinary case there's not, you then get SIPA insurance. So SIPA insurance isn't really the most important aspect of this issue. The most important aspect of the issue is, are crypto assets part of the allocation scheme in the liquidation of the broker dealer? And if there's an event with respect to the crypto that happens to cause the failure of the broker, do the other customers who are trading in kind of boring old securities, do they share in that loss?
You're thinking about the systemic importance of it, and I agree, but I'm looking at it from the customer's standpoint. What customer ever said to himself or to his registered rep, sure, you can sell me crypto assets, you can custody them for me, then when you fail, I'm uninsured? I mean, that doesn't.
Well, you know, in fact, that, I mean, look, that's true for a fair number of assets. And it's also why broker dealers typically don't hold assets that are illiquid. So it's not so uncommon. In other words, for example, partnerships are generally not held through a broker dealer. They're held, you know, with a direct relationship. So, There are a number of protections that are, I'll say, endemic to the broker-dealer scheme, that if you're going to say, hey, these assets are not securities or they're not ordinary securities, then, you know, you're moving them out of that protective scheme. Not necessarily a bad thing. You know, in other words, I think Hester is certainly an advocate for, you know, letting people make risk decisions and bear the risk of those decisions. But you can't have both full protection and, you know, no regulation. You have to make a choice between the two.
Understood. Justin, I want to come back to you because you mentioned state law earlier. My recollection is that the draft bill preempts state law on this general subject.
I think it's a little unclear at the moment, Pat, how far that preemption is going to go. I think it's fundamentally necessary, right, on the securities laws side to preempt state securities laws from treating digital assets like securities where they're not being treated like securities at the federal level. But, you know, right now, I think that the only provision on state preemption in there is with respect to the crowdfunding regime. And so
Yeah.
I don't think that the bill currently nails that point, and it's a fundamental one for it to actually be workable. We're already seeing state AGs, right, that have come out. Of, you know, there are state AGs that are working with former SEC enforcement lawyers who were disgracefully dismissed from the agency are now picking up helping state AGs bring the same type of claims that they were bringing at the federal level. So lawfare is never going to stop here unless we can get the preemption done.
This is what I describe as blue state risk in New York in particular, but I'm in Illinois. Don't rule that one out. In California as well. These are places, the whole West Coast, actually, where, and I don't think it preempts a state money transmission law.
It's really an additive regime rather than a preemptive one. So I think practically, we have. I think we're regulated by, at this point, 47 states. Some states are outside of our scope. But the practical realities is that we're hearing from the states, almost every day, sometimes once a week. And there is something, I think, to be said if you are having a national. I mean, it's not the most efficient, but we do have a lot of touch points on a lot of different areas. Anytime there's something in the news, right? Anytime there's a question that someone at one of these state regimes has, they call us. We have quarterly, yearly reports. We have examinations with the states. I do think that it's going to be hard to completely preempt, at least politically, all state involvement. That you can imagine what the DFS would say and what they would tell congressmen and senators about. Well, why should New York be completely cut out? We're the only ones who, have really been going after this industry. I don't think that's true, but you can imagine what they would say. Illinois is about to pass probably their own bit license in the next, few months. Yeah, right. California has one coming in. So it is, I think, a very difficult kind of line to tread, which is, okay, we want to have some oversight, some federal regime. But there is an infrastructure that's working pretty well right now at the states. There's a lot of companies that have gone through and gotten state licenses and developed those relationships and are examined yearly by them. How do we balance that? And that is not something that I think has been grappled with. And I think for the most part, the advocates of a federal regime basically take the position of, well, we don't care about the states. And, as a federalist, that always concerns me.
Yeah. I understand. Here's a question from the audience that I will throw out to the panel. I think Lee has some thoughts on it, but does the proposed legislation adequately deal with problems uncovered in the collapse of FTX and Voyager, for example? Plainly, those problems drove the agencies in the last administration to take the approach that they did. And FIT 21, I think, was intended to address some of the problems of FTX, the Senate bill too. What do you think about that? What it does do is it regulates crypto assets that are cash commodities. I think that's the core point. It clarifies that there will be a regulator, and that regulator in the early stages, at least, will be the SEC.
I think in a lot of ways, the regulators caused the FTX problem by discouraging banks from acting as custodian. I think once you allow banks to act as custodian, it becomes prudent for investors to hold in a entity that is heavily regulated for custody. So, it kind of goes back to, the fact that you don't force people into regulation doesn't mean they may not seek out regulation. And I think one of the huge mistakes that the regulators made was discouraging regulated entities from acting as custodian. I think you can attribute a lot of the losses to that.
I strongly agree with what Steve just said. I think he's absolutely right. The only thing I would add is the regulators also didn't go after FTX when FTX had U.S. customers and should, you know, probably have been within the jurisdiction of U.S. regulators. So that was probably another failing. Yeah. Instead, they spent time going after good old U.S. companies like Kraken and Coinbase.
Oh, well, and before that, don't forget the Kardashians. They were very busy with the protecting us from the Kardashians while FTX was failing. Miles, any last thoughts?
No, I mean, I agree with all that. I mean, I think that the, you know, pushing the industry offshore, which is what the regulators did over the course of the last 4 years, has only kind of increased the level of risk and is exactly what led to FTX. I do think that the regime proposed by the bill would provide safeguards against another FTX, both by, you know, providing a regulatory framework for exchanges that are, you know, giving access to U.S. persons, but also by encouraging more of the industry to come into the light and operate in the U.S. without fear of regulatory persecution. That said, you know, some of the concerns that Justin outlined around kind of, you know, duplicative and, you know, just ever increasing layers of regulation on some of the exchanges, you know, does create, I think, some, you know, some concern. But for the most part, I do think that it's directionally helpful.
I would, Justin, I'll give you the last word and then I'll ask Caroline to please close for us.
I mean, I agree with what everyone said. I will say that my general view is that we should be incentivizing people to build to their highest and best use. And I think the result of the last several years is we have incentivized people who are brilliant and interested in blockchain and crypto to either build products that have no utility, to build in the shadows, or to leave the industry. And I do think that we have an opportunity now to course correct. And my hope is that when we're, you know, having this conversation in a couple of years, right, 4 years later, what is the result? It's that we do have a robust industry where, you know, graduates from our best schools are trying to build here like they were in 2016, 2017, but they without the fear of persecution.
From your lips to God's ear, Justin. Caroline, please take us out.
Great. Thank you so much, Pat. Well, on behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank our moderator and speakers for the benefit of your time and expertise today. Thank you also to the audience members who joined us. We greatly appreciate your participation. Check out our website, fedsoc.org, or follow us on all major social media platforms at FedSoc to stay up to date with announcements and upcoming webinars. Thank you once more for tuning in. And with that, we are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. For more information about the Federal Society, the Practice Groups, and to become a Federal Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.